You're listening to the Mentoring Developers Podcast, episode 35. Check us out online at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode35. There you will find show notes with links. You will find a transcript of the interview and a lot more, including links to subscribe to iTunes and Stitcher Radio. All right, here we go.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
In this week's episode, my guest is Rachel Ober. Rachel is a Ruby on Rails developer based in New York City. She works at a company called Paperless Post, where she serves as a technical mentor for all front-end developers on the development team and also leads development, front-end development for the company. That's pretty impressive, especially for a woman. But do you know why I like her so much? I like her because she went a step ahead and co-founded a conference called Write, Speak, Code. Now, that is a conference that encourages women to speak at conferences and provides a good support network for them. It's a great conference. If you're a woman, this conference is organized by women for women. So if you are a woman in technology and you're able to make it to this conference, I encourage you to do that. It's on June 15 in Chicago. And I have a 20% discount code, MENTORINGDEVS, that you can use during checkout. All right, here's Rachel Ober. Before we start the show, I have a favor to ask you. You know, this show is all about new and aspiring software developers and their mentors. And I want to interview and I want to bring out stories from all of you. Whether you are a junior developer, you want to be a developer, maybe you work with developers, hire developers, maybe you mentor them. All of these stories put together build for us a complete picture. And then we can learn from our experiences and find out how we can be more successful, more inclusive, how we can have diversity, how we can encourage people to get better and encourage people to come to this field. If you want me to interview you or if you want to be on a discussion panel, go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join. Hi, everyone. Today, I have Rachel Ober with me. Rachel, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm so excited to have you. I'm really happy. And I have been trying to get you on this show for a while, but we have had some scheduling issues. But there's something very interesting about you. You are a speaker and a presenter and a teacher. You focus on Ruby on Rails and you are a conference organizer, all of that. But there's something interesting about the way you started your speaking in your public career. That's a little bit unusual. You weren't asking for it. It just came to you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So I really did not expect myself to get to the point where I started my own conference with some friends. It wasn't until somebody had found me, put a contact, I don't have my email address public on my website, but I do have a form, and they reached out to me and they're like, hi, I know that you do Ruby on Rails and and you are in New York City. Would you like to teach at General Assembly? And I was like, would I? That sounds awesome. So that's a little bit of what got me into it. And it just kind of, I don't want to say spiraled out of control, but it was kind of the ignition point in my life that I was like, oh, wow, I can really do this.
This is awesome. I think that this is really inspirational for me personally, because you're a girl and women have certain issues when it comes to technology careers, and getting accepted is a problem. I think we're going to talk about this. You are an organizer for a conference that focuses on women and helping women speak, right?
Correct.
And so we're going to talk about all that because it's really exciting. And I think that all of us that we don't know about this conference, you should go and check it out. And if you're in the area, it's in Chicago. If you're going to be in Chicago, go ahead and get there. And we'll talk more about this. But
get yourself to Chicago in June.
Get yourself to Chicago in June. And Chicago in June, by the way, is the place to be. I mean, where else will you be, right?
Exactly.
Chicago in June. In fact, if it's not June, you probably shouldn't be in Chicago. So describe yourself for us. Who is Rachel Ober?
Rachel Ober is probably first and foremost a dreamer, a creator. I love technology, and everything about me has to do with software engineering, coding, creating something new. Even in my free time, outside of my job, I'm working on either coding one of my projects or helping others do something similar. I would also say I'm an entrepreneur. I wouldn't have really called myself that until somebody says, "Well, Rachel, you're really an entrepreneur. You started all of these things." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." But I definitely like being supportive of other people, and it all comes down to like things that I'm passionate about and being able to share what I've learned.
That's great. And you've been coding for a while. Do you remember your first encounter with programming?
Well, I would have to go really far back. And what I would always joke about this in college, about how my father conditioned me from a young age to be a software engineer. And whenever I told him that I had been telling people this, he actually said, "Oh, no, I really was doing that." And he was just is like, "Oh, OK." But from as early as I can remember, my father always supported me. And I have two younger sisters as well. So only girls in my family. And he never treated us like princesses. He would make us go out and do yard work, mow the lawn, not treat us differently. And he would bring me to his computers because he was also in software engineering. And he would tell me what different things would do, different things in the computer would do. And from an early age, he also made sure that I attended a computing class. So the first programming language that I learned was Logo. So I think that's the official name.
Yep. Basically, I remember the turtle language.
Yes, the turtle. And as how my mom and my dad described it to me, they said, "Rachel, we signed you up for this class that you have to take. We want you to learn this, and what you do is you move a turtle on a screen and then you flip over the page and you see all of these lines of code that tell the turtle where to move." So whenever I then picked up HTML later on, I think that visionary sample or example always stuck with me. So I think I dabbled with TextMate as my IDE, not really an IDE, but like then I used Dreamweaver. I always like had this mental model of flipping over the page and there was HTML there. that model has since like expanded and changed. But so that was back in, let me see, maybe 1992 or it was like in the early grade school whenever I learned that. And it wasn't until I got into middle school where I could really access the internet on my own without like being in school and really understanding what the internet was, that I then started to work with websites and wanting to create a website, and then actually graduating from a WYSIWYG editor into writing HTML rather than just dropping elements on the page. So that was like getting into programming. And then it's like, oh, I don't I don't like typing out the same thing to make the pages all look the same. And then that's where I picked up PHP and CGI scripting. And then I was learning about databases, and I'm like, oh, great. Now I can store all of this information. And my dad said he knew that I was really getting into programming whenever I could explain to him and I designed a database without like having to research a lot. So I was like, oh yeah, so I set up these keys and this is relational, like doing relational database work without even understanding what a relational, like I didn't call it relational database, but it was just, you know, like kind of picking up things like it came naturally to me. So that's like a really brief history on how I got into programming.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I think you're lucky, I would say, that your father was in technology and that he cared enough to share his passion with you and sort of seed that, put that seed inside of that soil and just let it grow. So, of course, it's your initiative. If you are a child, if you're a teenager, you're thinking about becoming a software developer, you may have an uncle or a parent or somebody else that you can look up to that is in this field and you can inspire to be like them. That's great. But
yeah, I think that's what so it's the same thing with my sisters. It's being able to not just think of careers as gendered and interests as gendered. We have to think about, like, even for our sons, that if they want to play with dolls or if they want to become a nurse, that should be available to them. It's not something that they can't be interested in.
Absolutely. I think that it's important to know that for most of us, it's not the case. In my case, when I was a kid, nobody in my family or anybody that I knew had ever done anything with programming or computers. Right. And
oh, really?
I had nobody to look up to, nobody to talk to. I had to figure everything out myself the hard way, every single thing, which computer to buy, which programming language to pick. And you know what I'm saying?
So how did you get into computer science then? Or how did you get into what made you interested?
I've always wanted to do it. I'd watch a documentary about a computer program or some kind of simulation or something that, you know, that like National Geographic, something. I don't know. It's one of those documentaries that are etched in my head. And I'm like, I know that there is a thing called a computer. And I know that there are people who are computer programmers that make the computer do things. And I'd only watched it on TV. And I had this idea of what it is. And one day early in my high school, I was walking around a used bookstore and I picked up a book on the basic programming language. And I was like, what is this basic? And it was apparently a programming language book. So I bought it and I started reading and I was hooked. I picked up the first night. I started just reading it like a novel because I was a junkie, right? I would read novels, an insane amount of novels. That's what I would do if I had free time. I'd go to the library and pick up like, you know, a dozen novels and I'd just go through them. And I'd love it, you know, detective fiction, all that stuff. And this was like a novel to me. And I was just reading it. I had no computer. I had nothing. I was just flipping pages. And in one night, I went through most of the book, like 2/3 of the book. And I was like, this is amazing. So I didn't have a computer. So I would write these little programs in my notebook. And for a couple of years, that's what I did. And I would have an idea. You know, usually, as you know, that when you're starting programming, if you're a kid out there, you don't have to create something from scratch. You're going to take something that exists and just tweak it a little bit. That's how we all started, right?
But yeah, that's definitely how I started. So I had a website that displayed my art. And what I wanted to do was have a forum of people who were essentially admirers. So I think maybe about 20 people. And to me, that was like a lot of people. And at the time, I was like writing a story about them. I mean, this is middle school and high school. So even though like the impetus for me to create the website was for my art, but I had such a greater interest in the end on the basic understanding of how to create a website than it just became so much more. But I started with installing this forum, and then people would be like, oh, can we get I forget which feature they wanted with the form. And I'm like, well, let's see what I can do. And what's the worst thing that I can do to this website? And yes, I made like certain things that would break it, but you can always, well, as soon as you learn the concept of version control, that becomes very important. And you can always roll it back. Mostly, especially when you're starting out, there's very little damage that you can actually do. Besides maybe overloading your server, like maybe make something really popular and then you get overages for the load on your website. But I created something and I posted it back to the creators of the forum software and they're like, oh, Rachel, this is great. How would you like to be? I think either I was fixing bugs in the forum software, but it was all open source. And I learned so much just by putzing around with forum code that somebody else had written.
That's incredible. So this is something unique about our industry. If you find some open source project, we emphasize open source because you can actually do something about it. There might be things you can help. There might be other projects that need help, that need fixing, but their source code, the program, the original program is not available for you to fix. But if you go to this repository called GitHub, go to github.com, and you find a project there that generally, if it's public, then it's going to be open source. And you start using it. After a while, you realize, oh, it doesn't quite work in a certain situation. You can change it. You can change it in your local computer and then push those changes back up to the original person. And that person can then merge those changes into his own repository or her own repository, and now you are what we call an open source contributor, right? Badge of honor. So that's something, if you do that a few times, then people will take notice.
Yeah, especially if, so this is something that can be very hard for open source maintainers, is that say you've spent a lot of time and emotional labor into creating this project, and then you have a bunch of users, it becomes popular, they start finding bugs, they can really take a lot of emotional energy out of you by saying like, oh, fix this, and this doesn't work. You can give back to your community, you can give back to this person who's created this wonderful product or project for you by just like taking a look at their issues in GitHub, which is public. See if you can fix something. And then talk to this person and say like, hey, I noticed this was broken. I went ahead and this is how I fixed it. What do you think of my pull request? A lot of times they're very happy to talk with you, walk through the code that you've contributed and merge it into their branch. I mean, merge it into their project. And that's like a really great way to not only learn more about the tools that you're using, but give back. And really learn from somebody who's been doing it longer than you, because they can critique you on your code style, like any security things that might be an issue. And I really think it's a great way to find a mentor too. Even if it's a short relationship, just over this period that you're bringing something to the table, but it's still a mentoring relationship. You are finding help from somebody who has been doing this longer than you.
And one more tip is sometimes the project maintainers like to get contacted before you send in a pull request. So you might want to just send an email to say, hey, I want to try to fix this issue, because maybe somebody else is already working on it.
That's true too.
And sometimes they want to talk about the approaches and they can guide you a little bit. And I've known some open source projects that are very, very encouraging of new people to come in and become contributors and send in pull requests, but they always ask you to, hey, ask me first, because then I can show you maybe there are two ways of doing it, and one way is in line with the way they do things, and so there's a higher chance of your pull request being accepted.
Yep.
Okay, so now let's talk about how you went about constructing a career. You were interested, fantastic. You had a good beginning. You had a fantastic dad, and you know, high five him if you see him, because he's amazing.
I'll tell him to listen to the podcast.
That's amazing. I dads like him, they energize me because I want to be a dad like him, right? I have two little daughters and I've been trying to indoctrinate them into programming. One is almost two, so it's hard to indoctrinate her. the older one.
Well, if they have an iPad or a tablet or something and they love a game, you can say, you know, you can create something like this.
Yep.
And just seed that information. I think having not just being consumers, but being creators as well is such a powerful thing.
Absolutely. So now you're doing all of this and you are learning programming and going through school. At some point, you would have started to think about it as a career. Did you go to college? Did you say, hey, let me learn this professionally because this is what I want to do? Or were you just taking it as a hobby?
So I definitely, yeah, there was some struggle over whether or not I was going to take this dabbling of programming to higher education. And that was I don't think it took a lot of arm wringing to get me into programming in college. But I do think there was a bit of negotiation about that because as I mentioned, I loved art. I was doing computer stuff. I took a lot of computer art classes whenever I was in high school. And it was something that I really liked doing because it was very imaginative. And I had this struggle with being interested in computer science. Programming. And how I could fit those two things together. So I told my parents this, and at the time we were living in a Boston suburb, and I was introduced to the school, Northeastern University. Now they have an excellent computer science college, and I'm not just saying that because I'm alumna, but what really made it different than all of the other computer science programs that my parents were showing me was that they had started this idea of dual majors in the college of, well, not just the College of Computer Science, but they had it throughout the school. And in the College of Computer Science, they had dual majors of math and computer science, cognitive psychology, I think maybe biology at the time. Regardless, right now they have dozens of dual majors with computer science. And whenever one of my parents told me what cognitive psychology was, it made me think, oh, that's really cool. So cognitive psychology is about how you humans think and how they interact with things. And that really struck a chord with me because you're thinking more about what you're writing, what kind of tools you're creating, and how your users are going to be using them. So it was kind of I get to create, I got to do both things that I was interested in, that I was interested in the underlying programming, but I'm thinking more about how this is going to be used and creating something that is going to be meaningful to somebody else.
So how was your experience as a computer science undergraduate student in doing this double major, which is, I think, a very good idea if you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But you were taking classes, you were collaborating with students on projects, you were interacting with your professors. You spent a few years doing that.
Yeah, so the program was 5 years at Northeastern. And surprisingly, it wasn't because it was a dual major, but they wanted us to have a co-op experience. So for a total of 1.5 years, it was divided up into different semesters. We would actually go and take a job and for 6 months work full time so that we would gain that experience so that when we graduated, we already had a year and a half of experience.
That is highly unusual. And I think this is great. I think we should explore this a little bit further if we get a chance.
Yeah.
Because most colleges don't do that because they're not trying to produce workers. You know, computer science generally is about learning the science of computing, the theory, all the other finer points and principles and some research. Generally, my experience has been computer science and the departments of computer science are focused on that and not necessarily people getting jobs, especially in the public universities.
Yeah, I think in general, in general, universities are so extremely expensive and it's getting worse every year. Let's just be honest. that's why the draw of going to Code Boot Camp for less than a year is so attractive, even if it is a high upfront cost. It's because they're basically committing to bootstrapping you into a programming language. Oftentimes it's Ruby on Rails, and saying, like, we're going to teach you the bare minimum so that you can get out there and start working. And for somebody who either doesn't like their job, doesn't get paid enough, the attractiveness of being able to just go and get a well-paying job is just, it's just so mind-blowing.
Right. And there is this choice. If you have some money on hand, you could go to college and get a computer science degree or a computer engineering degree, or you could go to a code boot camp. For a lot of people, that's not a realistic choice, and a lot of people just want to have a degree as well. So, but for some people, that is a real choice. But I think for a lot of people who have moved on from their college years, and now they are perhaps working a job they don't like, and they want to switch careers, code boot camps, I think, are a fantastic way of getting their foot in the door for them. You never actually went to a code boot camp. I know that you taught at one, but you never were a student.
No, I didn't feel the need that I had to, because I always found it easy to teach myself a language. But I've met many people who need that structure. I have considered doing something like the Recourse Center, which used to be called Hacker School, and in that time, it's very open-ended, and you spend that time working on personal projects, and you're around other, like, the focus of that type of school is much different than a code boot camp.
Did you have any difficulty getting your first job? Because you already had some experience of co-op. I mean, co-oping when you're in college, that's incredible. So you had a resume, you had something to show. Was it just a snap of a finger to get a job?
So, let's see, I graduated in 2008 with my degree. And so if you remember back in 2008, there was actually a lot of stuff going on in terms of the Great Recession beginning, essentially. So I graduated and felt very honestly burnt out after college, because I had been doing so much with not only getting my undergraduate degree, but also the different student groups that I was in. So I did take some time off. I decided to adopt a dog and kind of bond with her and then start looking for a job. But at that time, I also decided that I wanted to find a job in New York City. And at the time, I was living in Pittsburgh with my parents. So that added an additional complication. And then also at that time, trying to think, it might have been more difficult to find a job doing Ruby on Rails, because it was still kind of like a new-ish language, and you really were going to find more startups doing Ruby on Rails rather than like larger companies or more well-established companies. And I wasn't really sure that I wanted to do a startup. I did end up doing a startup, but what was the original question? I don't remember now.
How did you get your first job?
How did I get my first job? Yeah, so I did want to move to New York City. My boyfriend, now my husband, was living there at the time, and I was like trying to be closer to him. And I found, I think I went either on monster.com and put my resume there. I remember I sent out dozens of resumes, and I think it did take like a long time to get called back. And it was very often that I didn't get any response to the resumes that I was sending out, which I think is disparaging. Like, I was talking to my dad. He's like, if they don't like even email you saying that you weren't selected, what kind of company is that? I think a lot of things have changed in that respect since when my parents were finding their first jobs. Hold on,
I think
one
it's
second.
Hard to. Yeah, it is. Hard.
My dog's whining. One second.
Oh, she can join us.
She wants to be in the room. She wants to be out of the room. You can edit this part out. She's just whining and it's driving me nuts. Go on, say what you were gonna say.
So I wanted to ask you about your choice of Ruby on Rails, because you were looking for Ruby on Rails jobs in 2008. Wasn't clear that it was going to be this big giant framework that will, you know, basically dwarf every other framework in the startup world. And for a lot of people, for a lot of new developers, Ruby and Ruby on Rails are the first their first experiences of programming, which is something that was not something that I would have expected in 2008. I was around that time, I was starting to learn a little bit of Ruby, and it was a very, it wasn't a new language, but it was not a well accepted or established.
Yeah, it wasn't well established, definitely not.
It wasn't an established framework. It wasn't very clear that you should be doing that, but and that was your first job. So, and I also know that in college, they don't teach you Ruby and Rails.
No.
So what got you interested in this, and why were you looking for Ruby on Rails jobs?
Yes, why, Rachel, would you look for Ruby on Rails? So it was 2005 at Northeastern. At the College of Computer Science, we had the student chapter of the Association for Computing Machinery, so ACM. And as a student group, we started teaching, the student group had, I can't remember what we called them, but we would teach students skills. And oftentimes it was programming languages, or we would have projects. And so we would have a student teacher who would be like a guru of this technology or this type of project, actually teach other students who were interested in learning it. So one of my friends, Chris Lambert, who is the CTO of Lyft, so shout out to him. He also introduced me to my husband. He did 10 minutes or 5 minutes to blog, whatever it was, everybody knows who started back then with Ruby on Rails, like that blog video, how to start a blog in 5 minutes with Ruby on Rails. And whenever I saw that, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like, you can prototype things so quickly with Ruby on Rails. And I think that was basically the draw for a lot of startups, was that they could do a prototype very simply with Ruby on Rails and get something up really quickly through the framework. And I just found that Ruby was a lovely language to work in. It had a lot of the things that I liked about other scripting languages that I had been using in the past. And it seemed friendly. And I think that's what drew me to developing with that language. And at that time, so after that experience, I started doing a lot more of my own Ruby on Rails programming, and I started converting a lot of the applications and websites that I had created using PHP into Ruby on Rails. Now, at the time, it was a little difficult to actually get web hosting somewhere with Ruby on Rails. So we had an experimental server at the college that I would deploy code to, and I would test it that way. And I converted my websites. I also took my capstone project, which was software development. It was a class, and every week it was supposed to kind of simulate what it was like in the real world and have like hard deadlines and changing requirements. It causes a lot of stress for students. And I decided to use Ruby. We were like one or two out of the group. There were like, you had to have a pair and you had to choose a programming language. And I chose Ruby, and there was only like a handful of us that used Ruby at the time. A lot of people were using Java and I think the .NET framework. No, that doesn't make sense. Because we weren't creating websites, we were creating like a command line. All right, so one of the most popular languages was Java. I can't remember what other people were using, but I remember at the time documentation on the internet for Ruby was very poor, and I had to create a lot of my own methods to get certain things working, or we had to deal with like really shoddy like other open source products to get certain basic things like XML working correctly. And even through all of this crazy stuff, it's like I saw so much potential in primetime work with Ruby on Rails that I kept with it. And I even convinced my final co-op boss to let me write this prototype software in Ruby on Rails. And so I guess I just got super crazy passionate and obsessive over it, if that makes sense.
That's a recipe for success, my friend.
But I mean, obviously I wasn't the only one, because, you know, I mean, maybe the hotness of Ruby on Rails has kind of died down, but there are so many legacy applications out there, and there was so much need in this this boot camp culture revolves almost exclusively around Ruby on Rails, or at least some part of it is with Ruby on Rails. And so there was an attractiveness to it.
Yeah. I think that a lot of people have moved on away from Ruby on Rails. I personally like the framework. It's still good. It still does its job. And its job is to create a very nice, simple abstraction, something in the model view controller, design pattern. It's not very pure. I'm not going to say that it's the ideal architecture, but it works for simple, small 80% websites, right?
So if you want to create, if you have a website and it's like, oh, I just need to connect to a database really quick, and it does all of this stuff for me. We're seeing this in my job as well at Paperless, is that once you need to like really get into optimizing your database and get away from some of this default stuff written in it and get into more complicated problems, it does kind of become a hurdle for you. And that's where you have to maybe delve into microservices or choose a different language or diversify things a little bit more. But I think to get an idea up, to really not have to reinvent the wheel, something like Ruby on Rails is a great choice.
And I think that it popularized the idea of conventions over configurations.
Yes, exactly.
Before Ruby on Rails, we were writing these giant XML files, which are really horrendous to look at, really hard to edit, and it was a nightmare. Right? Everything had XML, and there was more XML and XML inside XML and XML referencing XML. It was
XML in itself is not very user friendly or programmer friendly.
And it wasn't supposed to be. This is a good format for data exchange between computers. It's still good for that because it is really descriptive, and I will still say that even today, there are not a lot of good data exchange formats that are as comprehensive and as complete as XML. The only problem is XML is verbose and it's not really easy to look at.
It's also like, so going back to that capstone project with the XML, I feel like it was so, the way to write it was so diverse that whenever we would go in to parse it, like that's my main complaint with XML, is that it's kind of like, it was too ambiguous in certain cases. But that was also, we had like these random rules that we had to write in XML. But that's why I like JSON. But I think you're right in that the model, there's certain things that JSON can't do that XML may be better at.
Absolutely. XML can do pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Right? You can have a schema that you can, XML schema can verify, validate XML. You can do a whole lot of stuff. The problem is that you don't need a whole lot of stuff. 80, 90% of the time, you just need simple structured data. And people figured out that you can just do that in a regular JavaScript object. So that's why JSON was born. And I'm all for it. Right now, if I'm building a web service, especially a REST service, I'm not going to deal with XML because there is a better way. Mm-hmm. But you know why this is a better way, why JSON is a better way? It's because we've all agreed that it's a better way. Right? if I were using JSON and you're using something else, it's all JavaScript, but different notations, different formats, and I couldn't parse what you're sending me and you couldn't parse what I'm sending you, then it wouldn't work. We all coalesced around a simple format, and it's very simple, and we're like, okay, let's just use it. And obviously, I have to mention that there is this project called JSON API, which are trying to formalize a JSON format that everybody can use. Again, we're probably going to run into an issue where incompatibilities. I've seen that in Ember.js, where Ember is a very nice JavaScript framework, but by default, it expects a certain format in a certain formatted JSON in order for it to work because it's trying to do everything for you. Now, I think that we're getting into a lot of detail, was not my intention about these technologies, but suffice it to say that there are a lot of technologies, a lot of choices that we have to make. And as an industry, we are evolving and we are, I think, getting better. So that's good.
Yes. I think I there was a hot topic on Hacker News that was about Ruby on Rails, and like there's this idea of like, you know, hacker schools, like you can be, there's some people who are very hard lined, you know, you don't have to go to college to learn how to program. You don't have to go to college to get a job in programming. And while a lot of that is true, there is something to be said about going to college, learning about the history of computer science in order to make you a better programmer. And I would encourage anybody who did start off in a boot camp to take the time and learn more about computing, because I think especially as we see this evolution of so many JavaScript frameworks, we have like React, we have Angular, we have all of these different things that it seems like we're just kind of like reinventing the wheel over and over again. Whereas I read some comments from people who were like, yeah, we tried this back in the 80s and we found out it didn't work. And I think there's something you said about just kind of like understanding the history, understanding like when you're creating a new language about what people have tried before you and design patterns and learning all of these things so that like maybe you can make your life a little bit easier. Like still go out and create that new language or that framework, but like realize what you're like, the type of company you're entering maybe.
Yeah. And it's a good idea to learn skills. Certain, for example, you could be a JavaScript, Angular plus Node developer. That's a valid, legitimate path to go, and that's all you know. That's fine. But technologies change, companies evolve, people evolve, you will change. And so if you have the grounding, and you can get that grounding by going to college, or you can do it on your own. That's one of the benefits, that you can get started and then get all that backstory filled in later.
And that's the thing about college, is that they will not tell, there's like a very large gap about the actual pro, they leave it to you to learn a programming language that's going to get you a job. And if it wasn't for that student-led class after classes that introduced me to Ruby on Rails, I don't know when I would have gone out and learned it myself. And I even had a web development course that I took, and I'm like, oh, this is great. I know Ruby on Rails. I know PHP. This will be easy. But then I was required to use ASP.NET, and I was just like, I hate this. This class is horrible. Like, I don't want a job in ASP.NET. And I just didn't have a choice. And so there's some definite, and when you ask me about whether or not I went to a dev boot camp, I'm like, yeah, like that would, if you had the finances to be able to both go to college, learn everything that you needed to learn about computer science, and then actually take a class on how to apply it to the real world, that would be like perfect. But a lot of people don't have the time, money, and energy to do that.
So in the beginning, we talked about you going from obscurity, relative obscurity, to fame and fortune in this public life of as a public speaker and a teacher at a code camp or a code school. We're going to talk about this. Tell us how you transitioned. I know that how you got started, somebody just found you on the internet and you just started teaching at General Assembly, which is a code school. But beyond that, how did you take your knowledge and experience at that time, which was a few years? You weren't a 20-year veteran, but you took that and you did something with it. A year later, you've started this conference, and now you started this movement, I hear, and you're like making changes. You are really ambitious. I love it. I love that about you. Tell us a little bit about how you got from that place to where you are now.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words. So I think whenever I started teaching, first of all, there's like a lot of imposter syndrome that goes into this. And it's like, oh man, am I really going to be able to teach them everything they need to know? And oh my gosh, what if I tell them something wrong? You kind of have to get over that, because you're looking, the students that I was teaching, it was an after-night course. It wasn't like a hardcore boot camp. I was teaching twice a week after work. And a lot of the students also had day jobs. Many of them, especially whenever I started in 2012, did not have any aspiration. Well, I'm sorry, they didn't have jobs in programming. they thought, wow, this programming stuff seems cool, but I don't know the first thing about it. They wanted to invest a little bit of money into it because they tried and they couldn't do it by themselves. So they wanted somebody to help them. And it's very like demanding to have all of this emotion around whether or not you're going to do a good job. But if you can help somebody understand and even expose them to the basics of programming, you start with like data structures and you get this confidence in yourself to say like, yes, I do know this. I am good at what I do. I can teach somebody the beginnings. Like, okay, I might not be an expert at every little thing, but I am able to teach people what I know. And so after that, it was just like, okay, I can get up in front of people and I can talk about this. So conferences, a lot of people are talking about conferences right now and getting more women to speak. Could I be one of those people? And I didn't know the first thing about how to write a proposal to speak. I've done all through school. I did presentations. I did science fair. I did like a fair amount of public speaking, not at a large scale, but I didn't have any fear about getting in front of my class and talking. So that was probably built in. That wasn't something that I had to really start from at an older age, but I was finding it really hard without like talking to individual people about how to do this. So I kind of went out on a limb and just started researching and writing proposal, and I submitted them to a few conferences in 2013. At the same time, I started talking with my friend Rebecca Miller Webster, and I met some other people. I had known Chris Wu, who was also one of the founding members of Write Speak Code, and I'd known her through the Ruby on Rails community in New York City, and we just kind of started saying like, wow, I wish there was something out there that could just tell us everything we needed to know. Why don't we just create it ourselves? And it was kind of a crazy idea. It's like, could this work? Like, can we really do this? And it's just, it was also like, well, at least for me, because I hadn't done my first conference talk until I think it was June that year at Ruby Nation. Like I hadn't done my own talk, and here I am trying to get other women to do a talk. Like that is like true imposter syndrome. It's like I have not even actually given my own talk, and here I am trying to get other women to do it. But we started Write Speak Code because we wanted these resources, and we were learning all of this stuff, trying to do it on our own, that we wanted to give back to other people. We wanted to help them, and we wanted to be that resource for people. And especially women who might feel intimidated to walk into a group or a group of men and feel intimidated. And we wanted to give them a safe space to be able to ask their questions without feeling judged.
I think this is really important. There are a lot of groups, or should I say, there are a lot of people within different demographics and different circles and in different parts of the country and parts of the world, in different circumstances, that will not have the courage, will not have the resources, the money, or the ability to go out there and present, go out there and let people know what they know and interact with people, right? So yeah. Women, young women especially, sometimes they have difficulty in breaking through into this largely this male dominated industry. We can change that. I think women like you are changing that, which is fantastic. And I want to know if you've encountered yourself any issues being a woman trying to become prominent, trying to become acknowledged, or getting acknowledgement as an accomplished developer, or getting the respect maybe yourself or maybe people that you have come across, women or other people, maybe men as well, that you think that and do you have any tips for them?
I think I find more discrimination, that might be a hard word, from my experience, in contrast to what I've heard other women encounter. I think I feel I've I've felt that discrimination more in my day job than going out and speaking. And I think that's also in the venues in which I choose to present. And that's based on the conferences that I've chosen to submit proposals to. So I'm very cautious with that. And I could probably be a little bit more bold in where I choose to present. But like the biases I've encountered, which are, I think, might be a little bit odd in my position because I did start as a full stack Ruby on Rails developer. And I have since moved into more of a front end architect and have done speaking on that, in that I was pretty well known in the NYC Ruby on Rails community. So whenever I told them that I did front end development, they're like, oh, really? And plus, I taught back end Ruby on Rails. And that being at Paperless Post, a lot of anybody there really sees me just as a front end developer. So I kind of live in these two worlds. And sometimes that was hard to kind of deal with. Whereas like if I'm talking at a Ruby on Rails event or with other Ruby on Rails people, they don't necessarily see me as being knowledgeable in front end. And this can be both men and women. And then being at work and being able to also have competency and seen as having competency with Ruby on Rails whenever my main day-to-day job is orchestrating front-end work and everything that entails there. So there I'm seen as an expert in front-end, but nobody really asks me about my breadth of knowledge with Ruby on Rails. So I don't know if that is because I am a woman or just kind of like within the contexts, but I've also been in situations where someone I didn't see as having exceptional skills and would be on my level. Like, so we were at the same job title, more or less, being developers, and this person got promoted as my boss, and this person was male, and his boss was also male, and it was very obvious that this person preferred male company and respected males more than women. So that was probably the first outright bias that I saw. I think being a woman in technology and being fairly confident in their position, I think for me it was more obvious that when I had a male boss, they didn't really know, or they felt, I could sense like very, very obvious discomfort in them being able to talk to women and a woman. And especially as I get further along in my career, I think it's more difficult for me to maybe, I don't know if promotion or just kind of like feel like you belong, because I think some men do feel uncomfortable being alone with a woman. Like, are they going to be, seen, it's just kind of like that decorum that is ingrained in our society. Like, even though we're so far ahead in some social things, it's like if you see a man and a woman together, like it's a romantic thing going on. You can't. It's almost feels awkward still that a woman can't get mentored by a man without it being seen as she's like something else fishy might be going on. And then it's still like, as a woman, so I think sometimes I feel awkward trying to teach a male. And I think that might be just me personally seeing how, like, as a woman, does he like having questions? Does he respect me? Like, does he come to me whenever he needs help, or would he prefer talking to man? Like, we still have these ingrained things in our society that are preventing us from having this clean exchange of information of the genders.
Yeah, I think this is complicated. I think we shouldn't brush it off as something that happens for one person. So that's just Rachel's story. No, this is a story of most women, and they get so used to being treated differently and sometimes being mistreated, and in terms of not getting the same salary as men and not getting promoted when they deserved it, and being talked down to and not being treated equally and with respect and all this. And we know that it happens. It doesn't just happen in software development.
Oh.
It happens everywhere.
Yeah, like I'll tell you the story right now. My husband and I recently just had to buy a car. We didn't want to go in there needing to buy a car, but our other car was 9 years old and it got into a minor fender bender and it was totaled just because the car wasn't worth much. Anyway, we had to go and buy a new car. And when we got back, after going through a day-long process, my husband said, I was so irritated with that salesman. He was just so obviously sexist. And he just completely ignored you. And I'm thinking to myself, really? Was I that just so... It's just like, thank God for my husband, maybe, that he is mindful of these social conventions, that like, even whenever I'm not paying attention, that this injustice to me is happening. So it was very striking to me that like I'm acquiescent in this world. And even whenever someone who is like constantly trying to get out there and changing the status quo, that I can just let that happen to me as well.
It happens. And some of it is malintentioned, but I believe most of it is because people just don't know what to do. And this is one of the reasons I started this podcast, because I want to bring these issues out into the open. We can talk about these issues, especially from the point of view of people who are going through these issues and some other people who might be completely ignorant and they just don't know that what they're doing and what they're saying is having this kind of an effect on people. I believe that most men and most managers and most people in authority, once they know what to do, once they're shown the way that's appropriate, they'll do the right thing because they're not malicious. They just don't know.
I think that's probably right. I have met, I mean, there are some people, we have to also be honest that there are some people out there who just are not going to change and be able to, as people who do get biased against, get discriminated against, be able to handle that disappointment. And I think, well, at least for Right Speak Code, what we always tried to do from the beginning is that there's definitely a time and place to complain, but we want to be able to focus our efforts on helping women, helping people get the confidence, be able to handle situations and be able to move past people who want to either not see us succeed or even hurt us.
Yeah, there are always going to be people who don't have the right intentions. But my belief, and this belief is important, I think, because if we lose this belief, then basically we are at war. We can't be at war in this industry. I think what I would like to believe is that most people are good and nice and kind. They just don't know how to be nice and kind and good. And so...
I'll say it myself. I wasn't always as open-minded as I am now. I will say whenever I was in high school, I did not have many female friends. I tended to make friends easier with men. And I even didn't like the idea of being a woman and being a girl and being a female. And I had a lot of bias against ladies who reveled more on being effeminate. And I definitely had to change my views in saying, like, who cares how you dress? It's all about, you know, the brains and being able to disassociate those things. So I've been able to change, and I also believe other people can too.
Fantastic. I think that we could talk on and on for hours. And
absolutely.
And I think we probably have to have you on this show again at a later time to talk about some other things. We didn't get to anything about mentorship and all of that, but we'll probably get to that later. But right now, I want you to tell us a little bit about this upcoming conference that you're organizing.
Sure, I would love to talk about it. Right Speak Code, this is our third international conference, and this year we are holding it in Chicago. The past two times that we held it, starting in 2013, have been in New York City. Our intention was never to only have it in New York City, but it just happened to be where it was the easiest place for a lot of the organizers to get to it, and they lived there. So it's in Chicago this year, And this year we've introduced a fourth day, which is outside of our original curriculum that has to do with self-care and career development. And that was something we added because, again, we wanted to have, it was something that we wanted to see. And all of the organizers had been in a position in the past few years where they were burnt out, they were overworked, they were reconsidering whether to even stay in the technology field. Like, it was so hard that we all had to learn independently about how to do self-care. And we all had a conversation where we're like, yeah, it's, you know, it's just hard. And we all had to learn and identify when self-care was so important. So that's the fourth day. And we also introduced our alumna track. And this is not just for people who have attended the conference before, but people who have spoken, because even though we have like a curriculum for a write day, a speak day, and a code day, we wanted to be able to offer a space for people who have done all of these things, but are still looking for inspiration on how to get to the next level. So our conference really is for women who have been in technology, in the industry for a number of years, and want to do more. So our alumna track is based on, great, I've already been speaking publicly, I've already been writing publicly, what else can I do? So this involves in writing ebooks, creating independent projects, better communication skills, and we've sourced some of our friends who are really great at these topics, but we've also included people through a CFP process to really talk about more of these intricate topics and how to be better communicators.
So is this open only to women?
Yes, it is open to cis and trans women because we feel we needed to create a safe space for this group of women to be able to talk about their experiences. And it's not that we don't love men. We definitely do. But we did want to serve a specific community. And this was how we decided to do it.
I think there's a lot of room in our industry for different conferences catering to different demographics. It's cool. We should support our women. And if you are a woman, if you're listening to this and you want to be a software developer, or you are a software developer and you want to go and be out there and present or be get better, and if you are a presenter, that you can certainly learn other skills to move your career forward, I recommend you go to this conference in Chicago happening in June 2016. And Rachel has been kind enough to offer you guys, the audience, a 20% off coupon off the ticket price.
Yes, we want people to be able to make it. Actually, we offer three levels of ticket pricing. We offer the regular ticket, and that's intended for attendees who have their employers pay for it. So That is like the ticket price we want people to be able to give us so that we can cover our costs. But we also have a transitional ticket price, and that's either for people who are unemployed or they are paying for the ticket themselves and do not have their employer sponsored. And then we also have the student price, and that's for someone who is in college or taking a boot camp, because we want them to be able to make it to our conference. So we really believe, we really try to make it affordable to different demographics, and give out discount codes, give out all of these things, and try to communicate to many different user groups out there and different types of people so that they can come.
Okay, so if you want this 20% off discount, go to the WriteSpeak code website. Go to register and use the coupon code MENTORINGDEVS, which is conveniently the same as our Twitter handle, MENTORINGDEVS, MENTORINGDEVS. Just enter that and you'll get 20% off. Is it 20% off all tickets, or is it just a higher price ticket?
I believe it's for all tickets. If you have that is how I tried to set it up. If you have any issues, feel free to reach out to us at info@writespeakcode.com. Because we would love to work with you about getting you to our conference.
Absolutely. And I wish I were a girl so I could go to that conference. I'm not allowed. So, okay. Well,
we want to be able to offer, stay tuned. We're hoping to work on some stuff to make it available to everyone.
I think you need to issue certain observer class tickets to people here. You can watch from a distance. Yes. You can listen in, but you can't go to the actual, actual venue. You will be on this side play, this other place where you just sit, you can watch on a big screen, but you can't go. Just kidding.
You're missing out.
I think that there is a, this conference, I'm sure, will evolve and we'll see how it goes. But so I just wanted to make sure that I give a shout out to you guys. You guys are doing a fantastic job. You're not making money from it, right? This is not a business.
So we just recently registered it as a nonprofit. We are attempting to get 501(c).
Or I think it's C3.
C3. Yeah, I always say it wrong. So that it can be, so that we can offer tax incentives to companies. And no, we really don't make... I wish I was making money off of it, maybe one day, but it is mostly a labor of love for us, and we have such a great team of volunteers who are so passionate about this as much as I am, it takes a lot of, despite what maybe some people think, it actually takes a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort to run a conference. We don't really make money off of it. Anything that we make off of it is usually reinvested into other things that we do.
All right, guys. So it's our job to make this conference a success. Hopefully we'll have a full house. We'll sell out the tickets and then let me know how it goes. If you don't remember the discount code I gave you, go to my website, go to this website for this episode, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. That's how all our URLs are. And there'll be a section with links and there'll be a link for this coupon code. And go ahead and check it out. Let people know about it. And Rachel, it was such a pleasure talking to you. I hope that you find time to come back to the show at some other time.
Absolutely. This was lots of fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. And finally, is there a place people can check out? I know that you have a website, you have Twitter. Do you want to share some of that with the audience?
Sure. I'm known everywhere as Rachel Ober, R-A-C-H-E-L-O, B's in boy, E-R. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, GitHub. RachelOber.com. That's everywhere.
All right, boys and girls, that's a marketing and branding tip for you.
Oh yes, I could talk about that. Yeah, like self SEO. I think we have a talk on that this year on our alumni track about self branding, which will be great because I know I had to learn a lot just to get my name out there and everything. So yeah.
Absolutely. And it was a pleasure talking to you and we'll talk to you later. And everybody out there, talk to you later.
Great.
that was weird. What was talk to you. What does that mean? Talk to you later.
You are talking to them later.
No, I should say. Okay. Let me do this again. So all of you out there, I'll see you later. Now see you later and talk to you. I'm not going to see them or talk to them. But yeah.
Until
next time. This is Arslan, signing off.
Sounds good.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can read the highlights and show notes with links on mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. For example, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode 10 or /episode 25 and so on. Let me know what you think about this episode. If you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment, you can email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. Oh, and one more thing. I really want you to be part of the show, even if you are a little shy. So go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.